Accession number 10934, rule 4.
General Roll, rule 4. So you were saying that you now were in Romania,
yeah,
and the Russian campaign was, yeah, about to begin.
Yeah. Which was actually was a surprise to us, till it was really fact. And shortly before we invaded Russia, we recognized this is going to be a war against Russia. And the first day, on the very early day, I was at the foot of the Carpathian Mountains, and in Mamaia, close to Constanza. In Constanza there were big refineries, Romanian refineries, and the Russians attacked these refineries and the shipping of oil coming from Krim Peninsula with two engine bombers, DB3 and whatever they had, and in units with about 20 across the Black Sea in an altitude of 6,000 meters, and they dropped their bombs right into Constanza. And there was a German flak unit, and the commander was very excited because there was no big success from his side. And I got the order, I remember that, staying Misil at the Carpathian Mountains, I got the order to go with my squadron this very evening down to Mamaia. Mamaia is north of Constanza, next to Constanza, right at the shore of the Black Sea. So we just went down, the whole squadron, without any preparation. There was no fuel, no radar, no ammunition, nothing. No tent, no nothing. We landed at dawn. And this very evening, you 52 came with fuel. And they just dropped the barrels out of their airplanes. And for every airplane, 2-3 barrels. And we had a hand pump. I remember that. The pilots had to pump up their aircraft by himself until the mechanics came in another use. So we had the absolute minimum what we needed. We got mechanics, we got our ammunitions, and we got the core of our squadron with the ground crew just to be able to fly. This very evening I went down by car to this flight commander to get introduced in this whole situation. And he said, oh, God, I'm so happy that you are here. They come every day in the morning, 20 and so on, drop the bombs. Okay, what to do? I didn't have any radio. I didn't have any telephone. I didn't have nothing. So I said, okay, at dawn. How is it? Dawn, yeah?
Yes.
Early in the morning. At dawn, cockpit alert, and two ship element out at 6,000 meters over the Black Sea. About 10 kilometers, 20 kilometers, flying patrol. I knew exactly the only target they said is Constanza. They had to come here so we could get them up. We were in the cockpit and listened to the radio over the phone. And pretty soon, the patrol element called. They're coming, exactly locating altitude, heading, and distance from the shore. We scrambled, and we got them way out on the ocean. And they had tremendous losses, you know. They were unescorted. I mean, they had gunners in the back, everything, but they didn't have fighter escort. So we hit them, seriously. And they lost at least 50% of this element. And they turned, they never reached the shore. They dropped the bomb and escaped. And this continued, you know, just by the rigidity of the Russian thinking. It went on and went on 1 week. And in 1 week, we shut down 51 Russian bombers. And there was silence. But, on the other hand, certainly we lost also some pilots by the gunners. They flew in very close formation. You get a lot of guns against you. And very clever, one formation, Russian bomber formation, when we were out on the sea, engaged in this battle, they came over the Carpathian Mountains and came from the west, attacking the base. But they only hit some of the remaining aircraft on the ground, which was not operational, but they hit my ground crew. And this guy, I lost the main chief, the crew chief. He was an Austrian, an excellent man. He lost his legs, and he never recovered. A couple of days later, he died. And so many. We lost quite a number of ground crew and of aircraft, but the aircraft was not that important, you know. And when we came back, we still had enough aircraft, but this was only one single action which was a success for Russians. The lecture we got, and even we got it more in the home defense over Germany, but it is a first example. In those days, you never can fly a bomb raid without a fighter escort. And this is exactly what turned the whole battle over Germany in favor of the Americans when they came in with a long-range P-51s. And this killed German fighters, you know? But this was the first example.
What kind of Russian bombers were there, do you know?
DB-3, good bomber, no doubt, but without escort, coming over the siege, this was a deadly operation. Because, you know, they had to come to Constanza. There was the only target there. And we knew it, we were in Mamaya. So we got under all circumstances, we hit them.
We haven't said anything so far about radar.
Yeah, there was no radar at all in those days. Not at all. Never.
So your intelligence of the Soviet Air Force?
That time was very poor. Very poor. We had much better later on, when we come to this. But, you know, this was a brand new theater, brand new enemy, and very isolated. This was a completely different war, you know. In the West, you had firm stations, you had a communication system, and it's nothing true in this vast areas and wide areas, you know. Okay, then we came back. We got new pilots again, and then we moved into Russia.
You went back to Germany?
No, never. I was years out of Germany. We went back to Romania, to Misil, when the Russians stopped this. They really had too many losses. And they stopped it, and we had a small element down, and we came back to Misil and got the order to get into Russia to Bialaterkov.
How do you spell Misil?
M-I-Z-I-L.
And what's the name of the place you went to in Russia?
Bielaya Tserkov. This is south of Kiev in the Ukraine.
And when you say we went there...
The whole group. And from there on we were in Russia, you know, and attended all these... there I have to give you... The Russian front is a very... diversified one. It's not a uniform front of a theater. You know, in the north, they moved in and then they stayed for 3.5 years in front of Leningrad, stationary. In the middle, I was moved forward and back, and in the south, where I was stationed, let's say from Kiev down, Dnieper, Ukraine, Krim Peninsula, Azov, Mayor, Don, later on, Caucasus, Cuban bridgehead, Kerch, Stalingrad. This was a fast-moving war. And two-thirds, I was told, two-thirds, the majority of the Russian Air Force was certainly located in these areas of priority, where really it moved. And here there was a big battle. This means to us that on average we never stayed longer as at least maybe 1 week on one unprepared field. Sometimes we had a prepared field, came in, but the most was taken by bombers, by German bombers, by two guys. We as fighters, we were out in the open country.
What do you mean by preparing a field?
I mean with concrete and with hangars and barracks and things like that. We were out in a... We selected our field from the air. That's a lawn, it looks good, maybe I try. And what happened to me, you know, particularly when we came down to Caucasus. I remember we got the order from the army, had a close contact with the army and said, we're going down here. There was only spearheads, you know. This was not a solid front line. There was a spear and they said, we're going to reach this area in the next days. We need your support. And then we were looking, still it was still already, still enemy, but also not completely covered, you know. This is, again the landmass, the big, huge area, and only the few people couldn't protect the whole area. It was impossible. So, I flew in the air, two-ship formation with my wingman, and I saw, maybe this is going to be a good lawn. Let's try it. And during this, I got engaged in a dogfight. There were some Russian fighters flying around, and we just chased them away, you know. And obviously, they had to go. Maybe they were low in fuel. Then I told my wingman, you protect me, I'm going down. I try it. Then I came down. I said, Jesus Christ, this is a very short field, or maybe do it. And I didn't know if this is a soft ground or is this a swamp or whatever it is. And he dropped. Oh, God, I said, that was hard. And I rolled, opened my canopy, fixed my throttle, jumped out, and had a piece of white plastic. And I put it down as a landing cross or whatever you call it. Jumped in. Close the canopy, and here we go. And we were lucky enough to find this marker 2 days later in this wide area. You know, we found it. It was the next, it was Gonchakovka, by the way, near the Terek.
So can you give the name again?
Gonchakovka. But, you know, these places you never find on a map. There were 3-4 huts out. And we were in tents. And we had our airplanes underneath trees, you know. This is the time we operated. And the support, I mean, the coming to the logistic support. Again, we only were supported by U-52, because in those days we already had sent back our heavy equipment, you know, the trucks, and with all these big vehicles, we sent them back. We couldn't use them. They couldn't move in fall. There was no hard surface road. There was what we call a Rollbahn, where the tanks were moving with chains. We didn't have chains. There was mud, and they couldn't move. And then the cold season started, and the snow came, and was ice and so. So we sent it back, and we were. Supported primarily by U-52. We got fuel, we got our ammunition, and we were living in tents as long as the temperatures allowed it. And then we built little bunkers. We dug it out and, you know, we protected this. And this was the way the war was there.
What about the effect of the cold on your aeroplane?
It was awful. The first winter. I have to go back. This was what I'm told about Gonchakovka. This was the year 52. 51.
41.
41 and 42. 41, when we occupied and conquered the Isle of the Krim Peninsula, we were taken back and moved to the east towards Taganrog, Rostov, the Mirs, along the Azov Sea. And there we were hit by the winter. You know, what happened before was all these battles on Poltava, Kharkov, and there was a tremendous engagement. I come to the Russian air fleet right after that. You know, this is worth to talk about. But Setsuwa was 28th November 41 when I was shut down and broke my back three times, and this was for the first time finito. We were hit by the winter, down to temperatures of minus 40. You know, this was a problem to get the engine started in the morning, and we were not prepared. And we didn't have the overalls, we didn't have our mechanics. You know, we were not prepared for those tempers and for the winter operation. And it took quite a time to get the right equipment, the right tools, and the right hand gloves and whatever it is to match the situation. But before that, let me have some words to the Russian fleet, which we, you know, the first time I really ran into Russian airplanes was in the pocket battle of south of Kiev. This was in July or something, 41.
This was where the Russians were cut off.
Yeah, they you know, there was everywhere were these pocket battles, and the Russians lost a tremendous numbers of soldiers, of infantry, of artillery, of tanks, and in the air. They lost tremendous numbers of aircraft. They came in masses. And the Russian Air Force was structured as a tactical air force, primarily to support the army operation. And they were under the command of the army, of the higher command of the army. So they flew primarily ground support missions, no strategic missions or operative missions deep in the heart of the enemy territory. No, they and the front line, and if you flew to the front, they were there. They always was air operation. And later on, they had the predecessor of the EL-2. And they had this SU so-and-so, and it was two-seaters, bombers, medium, light bombers, escorted by fighters. But the fighter fleet in those days was a very obsolete one. You know, they flew with the biplanes up to the MiG already, MiG-3 or whatever number they had, this 109 shaped type, you know, but up from the still they still had some biplanes. This course that they came in numbers, but the quality and the training and the tactics and formations were inferior. I mean, the big pride of Stalin was the Air Force, but it didn't show up that way. This meant, as a result, that the Russians lost, until end of September 41, 7,000 first-line aircraft. What a shock. What a psychological effect on the Russian fleet. This is, I have to say, the greatest surprise to me. They didn't give up. They lost enormous numbers of airplanes. And you can imagine what it means to the fighting morale of a pilot, you know. But they still flew. They managed to recover by arranging a new production lines of their aircraft, way beyond the reach of German bombers, very effectively. And in the year 42, they run up to a production numbers of 12,000 airplanes, way beyond the capacity of the German industry. And they came in with modern aircraft. Yeah, they had this Lark MiG type aircraft then, and they had very good ones. They had, for instance, the Lark 5 was a very good airplane, and. Then later on, certainly, Anglo-American support was very, very important to them. They came in through Iran to Grozny and just engage in our theater. And I shot down the first Spitfire down in the Caucasus, you know. And when I wrote my report, I got a call from my higher command, said, are you crazy? Spitfire, we are in Russia. I said, you will feel it tomorrow. And tomorrow we run into a Spitfire squadron coming in, flown by Russians. They had the Erika, the P-40, P-39. They had the, as I mentioned, Spitfires. They had the Boston medium bombers. They had B-26s, all this type, you know, in numbers, which really helped them. So the Russian managed to recover from these first, from these losses in the first 4 or 5 months of the war. And with an unbroken morale, Then later on they formed elite units. We knew the names. Pokrishkin, for instance, he was in our area, he was a well-known pilot. They had these so-called Red Banner Guard regiments. They painted, some, painted like Richthofen, for one. They painted from the nacelle to the cockpit the aircraft red. Yeah, completely red. And they wanted to accept the fight, you know, they were looking for the fight. They were real, very aggressive fighters.
And how skillful were they?
Good. They were good. No doubt. They improved, they came, and they were very good. And this was came in 1942. And the American, English support came in, I think, the very... we could feel it and to see it. This was, I think, 43.
Now, can we return to the chronology?
Yeah.
Because you'd really left it with you having first gone into Russia, and you, I think, were telling me that your first real combats in Russia were in this Kiev pocket.
Yeah.
Can you tell me what happened there and tell me the incidents that happened to you?
We had... in the pocket, well, there was heavy air operations above, and 287 attacks, which still tactical use of the Air Force as a ground attacker. With the 287, we had escort again, but in a much more sensible way, the 287. And we escorted them down because the Russians waited just when they had to pull up. The Russians waited underneath and come in. And so we went down with them and protected them against the Russian fighters. And certainly we got a lot of ground flak. And this was my first hit when I got hit over the pocket. There was a tremendous, you know, there was tanks and fire and exploding and everything. It was a hell of a mess. And out of this mess, I got a hit by an anti-aircraft. And they hit my oil cooler. When I pulled up, the oil came up, and my wingman called, you got hit. You have a, you know what we say, the fane, you have smoke. I hadn't felt it up till that time. Then I saw my oil temperature and everything, and the oil came like a film. You know, we had an oil cooler right underneath the engine. And the oil came like a film just over my windshield. I couldn't see anything forward, nothing. I only could see here, a little bit here. To the side. And then I told my wingman, I got it, I have to belly in somewhere, and please take me over the Dnieper River. I knew the Dnieper River, I thought the Dnieper River is a forward line. West of the Dnieper River are Germans, and east are Russians, and these pockets. And I managed to just cross the river in about 200 meters or 100 meters, coming down, I couldn't hold the aircraft. And then I made this, and I saw a cut in a wood right in front of me. I headed for this cut, and I bellied into the forest. And it was a very, very rough, service, and it shaked me really up, but anyhow, I made it safely. The aircraft was damaged and wrecked. But I was safe, and I jumped out of the airplane because I thought, protect myself behind a tree. And when I was there, boom, I heard artillery firing very close. I couldn't see it because it was in the forest. And I was not sure if this Russian artillery or the German artillery. And all of a sudden, when I jumped, I get off my parachute, and I run through the forest from tree to tree, and all of a sudden I saw a man in a brown leather coat, a cap, pistol. So now that's it. Have you? I thought there's a Russian. And I came to him. I couldn't escape. That's why I came close to him. Maybe we had to fight. But it turned out he was a Slovakian. On the term, the Slovakians fought on our side. I was happy. And I went back to the next army company or battalion headquarters and said, here I am. Phone call. To make the long story short, the very evening I was back to my wing, down in Pyalatsarkov, to my squadron. This was my first experience. It was my first belly landing out in the forest.
When would that have been?
This was about July. When the Battle of Kiev was, July of early August. This area, the early days of the invasion of Russia. From there on, we moved down to Dnepropetrovsk, to the river crossing of the Neva, Kremenchuk, all these operations, you know, down to Krim Peninsula, moving in. There was a very heavy battle, you know, to get through this bottleneck into the Krim Peninsula. It was heavily defended by the Russians, and there was a tremendous air operations also, continuously. And Mölders was our... he formed what we call a Gefechtsverband, a combined unit, you know, with fighters and Stukas. And he was every morning flying with a Storch way out to the forward lines, and he had a radio. He didn't fly at that time, it wasn't allowed. And he called us he was the first forward air controller. Yeah? He directed us, and said, now turn, and here they come in, and then from there on it's our business. So, it was very interesting to be under his command.
What kind of a man was he?
He was a very fine man, a gentleman, and a very great man. Very talented and very intelligent. And from there, he was called back because to the funeral of Udet, you know,